Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about whales with Joe Roman, author of the book Whale, an assistant professor at the University of Vermont's Rubenstein School for the Environment and Natural Resources. We'll talk about his research with northern right whales and also focus on his experiences with whale dung and its importance in the marine ecosystem. Joe Roman was born and raised in New York and counts King Kong as an early conservation influence. He is a conservation biologist, as well as a fellow at the Gunn Institute of Ecological Economics and assistant professor at the University of Vermont's Rubenstein School for the Environment and Natural Resources. He's also a research associate at the New England Aquarium. He received his PhD from Harvard University in 2003 in organismic and evolutionary biology, and a master's degree in wildlife ecology and conservation from the University of Florida. During a fellowship with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Joe helped start an interdisciplinary program on biodiversity and human health at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. His most recent book, Whale, provides an in-depth look at the cultural and natural history of these majestic aquatic mammals. His next book, titled Listed, Dispatches from America's Endangered Species Act, will be released by Harvard University Press in spring 2011. His most recent research paper, which has been featured on National Public Radio and elsewhere, focuses on what he calls the whale pump. In other words, how the dung of these marine mammals enhance primary productivity in a coastal basin, something we'll get into in depth later in our conversation. However, when I spoke to him recently, I started by asking Joe what first got him interested in whales.
Well, I grew up in Queens, New York City, and on Long Island, so I grew up close to the ocean. And early on, my interests were probably the species that I could see, some turtles, some animals that lived in the salt marshes, and that's where I did my earliest work, found myself more and more interested in ecology. And that led several years later to when I moved to New England to working with folks at the New England Aquarium. And their focus at that time was the North Atlantic right whale, highly endangered species, only 300 left on the planet at that time, maybe 350. And for some reason, that really attracted me. There was a species that I felt like we could actually make a difference. If we could go out there, learn something about the species, there's a chance that we could actually save it. I was working with people that have been doing this for many years, but that was my earliest introduction to marine mammals. And since then, I've gone on to study several other species like humpbacks, some orcas or killer whales, and even looking at the marketplaces in Japan and around the world.
So tell me about the North Atlantic right whale. What do they look like? I don't think most of us are familiar with them. We're all sort of familiar with humpbacks, but what about the North Atlantic right whale?
Sure. They were known as the black whale or the right whale, and the reason they're called that is because they were the right whale to kill. They were slow-moving. They're black, as their name had implied, and they're very coastal. They don't tend to be as playful or as gamesome, I think it was what Melville called the humpback. I sort of describe them as the goths of the North Atlantic, brooding, slow-moving. They really are kind of moody, but nonetheless fascinating. They feed on microscopic copepods, have an incredible amount of blubber or oil, and that's partly why they were so attractive to whalers. And that's also the reason why they're so endangered. They were hunted to very low levels by the 1920s and became one of the first species really to be protected from hunting. Really, for these guys, it was almost too late at that time. By the 1930s, there was probably only a handful of these individuals left. After 70, 80 years of protection, they've come back, but we still have a long way to go in protecting them.
So today, how many are there left on the planet? Do we know?
Yeah, North Atlantic right whales, about 400, maybe 450 tops. The problem is they're not hunted anymore, but they're still being killed in part because of they are coastal and slow moving, so they get run over by large contained large ships, and they can also get caught in fishing lines, gill nets, or lobster pots. So although we don't intentionally kill them, they're still at risk in the modern ocean.
And how big are they? Say
Oh yeah, bigger than a bus. They're like they can get up to 40 tons. The females are actually larger than the males, and so enormous. I mean, their tail, their flukes or tails alone are like the size of a Volkswagen.
Really? And can you tell them apart by looking at their flukes, at their tails?
For right whales, you use what's called the bonnet or the top of their head. They have what's known as callosities. So there's sort of like growths of skin, cornified skin, almost like fingernails that grow on the top of their heads. And that is one identifying pattern. But even more than that, though, that skin attracts what's called whale lice. So it attracts types of crustacean that feed on that. And amazingly enough, that stays steady throughout the whale's lives. It moves throughout the whale's life, and it moves a little bit over the years, but that pattern on the top of the head is one way that people that are much better at this than I am can identify dozens of whales at sea very quickly.
What does it look like? What color is it?
It's white or grayish. These are the cyamids or the whale lice that's sitting on top of the heads. Again, the whale tends to be black. They might have some white patches on their bellies, but it's this sort of well, someone has described it sort of as looking like a bird's turd on their head. It's sort of spread out there like gray that sort of stretches out across their head. I don't mean to insult any right whales when I say that, though.
And that stays on their head in the same pattern throughout their life.
Yes, like I said, it might move subtly, but it is a living pattern. Of course, another way to identify them is by using genetics, but this pattern is one way that you could, is a good field marker. Friends of mine who study humpbacks don't understand how people, as you're sort of implying, can follow right whales when actually their patterns are changing over time. Whereas with humpback, you think of those flukes. Those color patterns tend to stay the same throughout their lives. They really are fixed patterns, part of the skin. Whereas for right whales, there is some change over time, but they do tend to have those same patterns across decades. And this species can live for 80, 100 years, maybe even longer. So that this pattern can it has been used amazingly to identify a female. That was shot in, the photograph was taken of a female with a calf in, I believe it was the 1940s. And friends of mine at the New England Aquarium saw that picture and could identify her callosity pattern, the pattern on her head, with a living whale at that time. This was in the 1990s. So they managed to match an individual over the course of several decades using
Wow.
an old grainy picture. And a living whale, so that these patterns really are persistent over a long time.
Wow. And then you mentioned genetics, and I know you've done a lot of work with genetics. I was going to talk about it later, but we might as well sort of get into it now. That you've done gene studies on whales and basically found that whales in the North Atlantic Ocean were far more abundant than scientists thought. Can you take me through your research and how you made that conclusion, what whales you were studying?
So this we were this was when I was doing my PhD at Harvard with Steve Palumbi, and he had been already working on whales for several years on the genetics of whales. I had done some field work, but hadn't done genetics yet. And what we had seen was that the genetic diversity in some species, this includes humpback whales, minke whales, and fin whales, three baleen whale species that have been hunted extensively for decades, if not centuries, that the genetic diversity in each of these species was much higher than you would expect given their present population sizes. What that tells you when you're looking at population genetics is there must have been, at some point in the past, a much larger population size. There's a correlation between genetic diversity and population size, and those studies have been done with humans to say the opposite of what we found in whales. That is, humans tend to have very little genetic diversity for the huge population size that we have. And that's because only, let's say, 100,000 years ago, a couple of 100,000 years ago, there were probably only tens of thousands of humans on the planet. We were almost an endangered species at that time, as some biologists would say. In whales, we see the opposite. Lots of diversity, only a few animals. What does that tell us? That historically, there were probably many more whales than there are now. Now, people already knew that, of course. We knew that there were whales out there at a higher number, but no one could really get an estimate for that. Just looking at the log books seemed to say, well, maybe they were, you know, twice as many whales as there are now, possibly 2.5 times more. Our study showed, well, actually, it may be 5 or even 10 times more. That is, the oceans could support a lot more whales than we had previously supposed.
What are the implications of that?
Sure. Well, one of them is that for the International Whaling Commission, they make their decisions. That is, the people that are in charge of setting when whaling can resume. One way that they make that determination is when whale populations are at approximately 50% of their historical numbers. That means biologically, we can start hunting them again. So if we set that bar, if we set the bar too low, that is, if we think the historical numbers are much lower than they really were, we're going to allow hunting much sooner than really should be biologically or ecologically, let's say. So one is we might start hunting them sooner than is appropriate. And also it shows us that the oceans could once sustain much larger populations of whales and presumably also seals and seabirds than we had known. So the ocean ecosystem, we've changed the ocean so much that we're really looking at an altered planet or an altered ocean. We need to be thinking about setting our goals at much higher abundances for lots of species that we now think of as endangered. That includes whales, that includes cod and other fishes, seabirds, seals, the whole suite of large animals in the oceans.
Now, how did you go about getting DNA material from whales, you know, from
Sure.
humpback fin and minke whales, which aren't too easy to find?
That's true. Well, so for a lot of these, there are a lot of biologists out there that have been collecting DNA or samples for years now. One way that it's collected is you have a crossbow, and you basically are going to shoot an arrow and get a very small piece of skin off the whale, a little piece of skin and a little piece of blubber that's taken off the back of the whale, and you can do, you know, lots of analysis from that. We also got some samples, actually, that had been collected by whalers historically off the coast of Gibraltar in Europe. So some were historic samples. Others were collected by scientists around the world. We were looking particularly at the North Atlantic, but we also needed to know what the genetic diversity was around the world, since diversity is both a reflection of population size but also migration between different populations. So a lot of it really came from either those small samples from whaling records or blood samples or other samples that have been taken from whales. And also right now there's a large database online called GenBank where you can find sequences of DNA for hundreds of species and hundreds of individuals.
And that has the information where and when it was collected?
That's exactly right. What typically most journals require when you publish a genetic study, that you put all your sequences, all of your data online. So it's freely available to other scientists, one, to look at your data, but also to do other studies. So after we published our work, all of our data sets went online, and we also used lots of data from other scientists in order to do our work.
Were you involved in collecting some of those samples yourself?
Not for that study, though. I've been involved with collecting samples later for humpbacks as well as for right whales and other species. And I've also helped out with some analysis of whale meat on the markets in Japan as well. In that case, I was working with Scott Baker and his colleagues. We went to Tokyo in order to look at what species were being sold on the market, what species of whale were being sold on the marketplace. If you're familiar with the restrictions of Japanese whaling, they're only supposed to be hunting, at that time, minke whales, one specific species of whale. The work that Scott Baker and his colleagues did revealed that actually a handful, possibly dozens of different species of whales were being sold on the marketplace rather than just the minke whale that had originally been, had that the Japanese had claimed they'd been hunting.
When you went to Japan, you collected samples of whale meat to.
Well, having a foreigner go around buying whale meat probably would stand out quite a bit. So
That's
there
what
was
I
that.
wondered.
Yeah, that's right. There was a Japanese national named Naoko Funahashi who did the work. She works for the International Fund for Animal Welfare out of Tokyo. So she had gone undercover for several years in a row. I don't know if she can still do that. Maybe she's too well known now. But in the late 1990s, she went undercover and bought whale meat around the country. Sometimes at great risk. I mean, she'd be going into, like, let's say, what's the equivalent of a sushi bar. When the sushi chef turned his back, she'd stick the whale meat into her pocket, into a plastic bag in her pocket, and take it away.
How did you carry the whale meat back for analysis? Or did you do the analysis in Japan?
That's a great question. So keep in mind, this was work led by Scott Baker, and I really was played a small role on this, but it was important. Important work nonetheless, I think, for the work that he had done and others. You can't take whale meat into the United States because it's restricted. There are laws against it, as you know. So what Scott and his colleagues did was, instead of bringing the whale meat into the country, there were no laws against making an artificial copy of the DNA and bringing that into the US. So what they did is they actually created a lab inside of a hotel room in Japan, and made those copies of the DNA, left the original whale meat behind, but then they had those identical copies that they could then analyze in the lab. I don't know what the keep in mind that this is the entire time they're working with dangerous liquids, white powders. The door is always shut. It says "Do not disturb" for weeks at a time. I don't really know the people that own the hotel were thinking, but nonetheless, it was breakthrough work at the time.
Yeah, no, it got a lot of press
Mm-hmm.
at the time. Then do you need permits to bring whale, these copies of the DNA into the country?
The Japanese tried to argue that you should, that it was restricted, but the U.S. Claimed that no, they were not, that you did not need to have permits to bring in. Because remember that what they were doing was making copies of the DNA. They had to make sure that not a single one of the original DNA couldn't come in. So you had to make a an artificial copy and bring that back into the country. Now, at the same time, as far as I know, Scott carried all of that back in his pockets, or something like that. This was pre-9/11. I'm not sure how easy it is now. He carried a lot of that stuff back without claiming it because you didn't, technically you didn't have to. But the Japanese might not have been so happy, had they found him leaving the country with that.
When you're doing copies like that, and this is, I guess, a broader question as well, is there an issue that it's not the original, scientifically?
Sure, there have. I mean, that has been the argument by critics of that work, that it was contamination. That, if you're making these copies and you're bringing them to lab, you're contaminating by your own samples that are in the lab. So there were people certainly that argued that. Scott had gone through several measures in order to make sh to ensure that that wasn't the case, either doing it in different labs or also finding novel DNA sequences from the ones that he brought in, indicating that that there was not indeed contamination going on at the time. But certainly that gave some room for critics, the fact that he didn't have the originals with him at the when he was doing the analysis in his own lab.
So now you've turned from meat to scat or whale poop more recently.
Right.
And I'd love to talk about that and what got you started focusing on whale feces?
That actually goes back, as you had asked, when I'd started studying whales. The earliest days that I was on the water, this was working with folks at the New England Aquarium looking at right whales, and we had gone out and we would be collecting genetic samples or doing photo IDs of these individual whales. And I noticed, almost, maybe from one of the earliest days on the water, that when the whales came up, they defecated. And if you know right whales, well, they have very strong breath. They have very strong smelling poop as well. So you can't miss this. It's a large fecal plume that comes out of the whale, also with some bright, often some brightly colored logs left behind. So when you notice this after a while, you know they're feeding at depth, defecating at the surface. And I had at the time been studying marine ecology. The typical story for a lot of organisms in the oceans is that when they feed, let's say, near the surface, and then they migrate down below, and their feces is released at the bottom of the ocean, therefore bringing nutrients away from the surface. Okay? Whales, I noticed early on, were doing the opposite. They were often feeding at depth, defecating at the surface. And that gave me an idea. Maybe they were actually fertilizing their own waters. Because if you know ocean systems, the algae or plants can only grow at the surface. So it's the only place that the nutrients are really going to matter is if they're at the surface. And because they only grow at the surface, they quickly deplete nutrients there in the summertime. So you get a limit of the amount of the algae that can grow in a particular area as the nutrients drop out. Whales, it appeared, were actually fertilizing their own gardens by feeding deep in the water column, coming to the surface and defecating, and increasing nitrogen and other nutrients in that area. So it was pretty much early on that I got that idea. It took me several years before I actually got out there and could start collecting it and actually analyzing the impacts in the oceans.
So what did this fecal plume of the right whales look like?
So for right whales, it tends to be kind of a large log that breaks up quickly. It floats at the surface. Just like the whales are buoyant, so is their feces. For something like humpback whales, and often other fish-eating whales, it tends to be what we call a large flocculent plume, a plume that disperses very quickly, looks almost like steeped green tea for humpback whales. In other words, it's very watery, and it goes out quickly and just sort of suspended below the surface, just below the surface, where, as we found, there's lots of nitrogen. And nitrogen is the limiting nutrient in that system. So when you have a lot of nitrogen in that area, you can have a lot of algal growth, a lot of primary productivity in that area.
So different whales have different looking
<That's>
scat.
<right.
laughs> And so what colors are they? You said that the humpback is like a green, a green tea.
It almost like a green tea, sure. It depends on their diet. For humpbacks, it can be reddish too if they're eating krill. If they're eating crustaceans, it tends to be more oily and it tends to be a different color. For the fish eaters, it tends to be green or brown. So it really depends on the time of year, on their diet, on the species. One of my dreams someday is to write a field guide to whale poop. I haven't done it yet. I think it would be fun.
Well, I'm anxiously awaiting that.
Okay. So then I'll have an answer for more species than so far seen.
Does it sink eventually, or how long does it stay at the surface?
Right. Again, every species is different. But there are studies. So in short, we don't really know. We do know that it's suspended at the surface for at least periods of minutes, 10 minutes, maybe even up to an hour. We also suspect that it's not sinking below what's called the thermocline. That is, there's a part of the ocean in the summertime, the upper part of the ocean as it warms up separates from the lower part. Because the nutrients get used up at that upper part of the surface, that warm area tends to have a very different chemistry than the lower surface, which is cold and nutrient rich. What we've found, and this is studies actually done looking at human feces, oddly enough, when they used to dump human feces off of New York, a friend of mine had the lamentable job of actually seeing the impact on whales of dumping human poop at sea. But what they found was that even human poop tends to stay at that surface zone. So no one to date, and I would like to look at this, has been able to analyze just how long the nutrients stay at the surface. But we suspect most of it stays at that, remains there until it's used up by the algae or by the plants at the surface.
Why just whale poop floating? Are there other species that whose feces float and can serve this purpose?
Sure. So when we first started this work, we focused on seabirds, pinnipeds or seals and whales. We were looking at the Gulf of Maine. We didn't know what are all three of those marine animals have in common. Well, they're all air breathing. And what does that mean? Well, that they have to come to the surface to breathe. They're not going to dive any deeper than they have to feed, because they have to. It's energetically expensive to dive. So all of those animals are going to be di are going to dive. Dive down, feed, and then come to the surface. They metabolize at the surface, therefore they defecate and urinate at the surface. So we knew all three of these animals are probably bringing nutrients up, right? They're going to basically bring nutrients from wherever they're feeding higher in the water column. The reason why we focused on whales is we looked at all three, but the biomass of whales in the Gulf of Maine is about 80% of all the marine mammals and seabirds. So they're much more important in New England that, as in this pump of bringing these nutrients to the surface. In other systems, if there are lots of penguins in an area particularly, or let's say where there are lots of walruses found, or other pinnipeds, you would find some. You might find that it's actually a walrus pump or a penguin pump. But here in at least in northeastern North America, it's whales that are driving the system. And in fact, it's largely fin whales. Now, I've yet to catch any fin whale poop, but I'm looking out for that. They're the largest animals that are found in the Gulf of Maine, and they're also very fast moving. So we're going to try and actually collect that this summer off the coast of Grand Manan in New Brunswick, Canada.
So how do you know that it's largely fin whales that are
Okay,
driving
well,
the system?
sure. In that sense, we're just looking at population data and average size for individuals. So we know there are so many fin whales in the Gulf of Maine. We know they're the largest animals there, several thousand, in fact, fin whales. And because they're the largest in size, they're playing the biggest role. Historically, it might have been right whales. Right whales now, as I'd said, are down to 400 individuals. Some people estimated there might have been 10 times, possibly even 100 times more right whales, though that number is controversial. Historically, right whales probably played a very much bigger role. It's just a matter of the fact that they're so endangered now. So you've got fin whales and you've got humpbacks that are really driving the system. Fin whales never really got hit to the low numbers that other species did, so they're still relatively abundant. In Northeast North America.
Does the size of the whale affect how big their feces are, or is that more a function of how efficient they are at processing their food?
So it's more just that how much they consume is how much they're going to defecate or how much they're going to excrete. So it's not that the feces is necessarily larger in any individual event, but that over the course of a day, a larger animal is going to consume more, therefore it's going to poop more. So that's more the issue there for fin whales. It's just that they need to consume a large bit part of their body weight over the course of a summer in order to breed, because for a lot of these animals, they're only feeding in the summer. They come to, let's say, the Gulf of Maine to feed, and then they're going to largely fast in the wintertime. There isn't as much food available. And for females, they're going to have offspring at that time, and they're going to be nursing. So they really have to eat a lot over the course of a summer.
So this whale pump really only works in the summer?
It's biologically most important in the summer. And that's for several reasons. One, of course, because the whales are feeding at that time, but also because that's when the nutrients are depleted. The oceans, and we're again, I'm talking about the Gulf of Maine here. In the summertime, rather in the wintertime, storms, wind, there's not a lot of biological activity. There's not a lot of photosynthesis at that time. So there's a lot of mixing. There isn't going to be a depletion of nutrients. The algae aren't growing to any great extent at that time. In the summer, however, when the algae is growing a lot, they tend to deplete their nutrients. Nitrogen levels approach zero, limits the amount of productivity in a particular area. That also happens to be when the whales are feeding and defecating. So they're playing a really important role in the ecosystem just when it's needed most, in the summertime.
Some critics of this work have said, well, the storms and whatnot can serve the same function of moving the nutrients from the ocean bottom to the surface. But there aren't as many storms and wind in the summer?
They're not sufficient typically to break that strong thermocline, that strong division between the upper surface and the lower surface. Sure, there is some mixing. Absolutely, there's upwelling. We know that there's mixing. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any productivity without whales. I mean, there are lots of systems going on here. Even humans play a role. Our industrial nitrogen coming off of industry and off of farms also reach these areas to a certain extent. So there's certainly some nitrogen going to the system. What's important about whales, though, it's very patchy. It's going to be, the whales are going to be defecating in a particular area, one in aggregations, but there's going to be small patchiness that's going to have very high productivity in particular areas. So, of course, there are natural systems. There's human-caused recycling or cycling as well, but whales play an important role now. And what we think is really important is historically they would have played a much larger role. If whales were at numbers that are 5 or 10 times higher than numbers right now, take humans out of the system, you could see how they'd play a very important role, not only in increasing productivity for themselves, but also making it available, that productivity is available to their food, to other fish species, and you can see how you could have a very productive system on a place, for example, off of Massachusetts called Stellwagen Bank, how you could have lots of cod and other fish species, but also lots of whales. So it's a rich picture that whales are playing an important role. That role in that system.
How often do whales poop?
I wish I knew. you ask these questions.
Well, we all want to know.
you ask. So sometimes we follow individual whales and they seem to be pooping all the time. And other whales, you follow them all day and they never poop. And I really don't know. But anybody who has had kids probably has had this experience in some
way. Right. So. And how do you find it? I mean, Big ocean, whale might be big, but it's not that big.
Sure. Two different studies that I've been involved with. One, we were putting tags on humpback whales off of Stellwagen Bank, and this is the work that we used for the paper. For the whale pump paper, we used humpback whales, and we were basically following along on a study that was putting tags on the back of a whale so that we could see what they were doing beneath the surface. Because biologists have been observing whales for decades, but we didn't know very much about what they were doing for most of their lives when they were out of view. By putting tags on the back of whales, we could follow what they were doing beneath the surface, hear them, see when they were rolling, how they were interacting with other species and other whales. But it also gave me a chance to follow them throughout the day. So we would be out there following whales all day, and anytime they pooped, I'd go out with a plankton net and collect that poop and then bring it back to the ship where we would analyze it. You might have heard that there's been some other really cool work with some colleagues of mine in New England Aquarium where they used a scat sniffing dog to follow whales at sea. This was done for humpback whales. It's also done for orcas off of Seattle. And what they're doing is basically there's a dog that's trained on the smell of, in this case, right whale poop, and he's on a small boat, and he will be trained to basically to wag his tail when he detects the scent of whale poop, and the trainers will follow the dog's basically indications upwind until they find a scat. And these dogs have managed to find scats at about a nautical mile away. So a huge increase in the ability for researchers to find poop if they have a dog with a very sharp nose. Now, as I had mentioned before, right whale scat is pretty strong. Humans can detect it at about 150 yards or 200 yards away.
What does it smell like?
But right whales is incredibly strong, briny, certainly smells like any feces, you know, very strong feces, or maybe almost like a fishy smell. And Roz Rollin would say, who's worked on, with this for several field studies, several years, if you get the right whale poop on your clothes, you basically have to throw it away. You're not going to be able to remove that scent. Others will say, by the way, that right whale breath smells even worse. So be warned. When I went out to study humpback whales, I was afraid because we were doing some work. We would be doing the analysis of the humpback poop beneath the deck on a ship, and I was nervous that I'd get nauseous working on it. But I have to say, humpbacks almost smell like roses compared to right whales. I mean, you can barely smell anything from it. So very, very subtle scent, really smells almost like the ocean. So again, every species smells a little bit different.
And do you get seasick?
I have on occasion, for sure. Fortunately, knock on wood, not very often, but so far, you know, on occasion, yes.
And what information, when you do the analysis, why is poop such a plethora of information? What kind of information can you find?
Sure. I mean, besides our analysis, looking at you know, nitrogen and other nutrients in the system, folks at New England Aquarium have studied parasites in whales to look at their overall health. There's evidence that they can contract Giardia and other parasites that are also found in humans and in domestic animals. They also can find evidence of whether they have heavy metals or other pollutants in their system you can find in the feces. There's also, by looking at hormone levels, you can detect stress levels, but also whether the individual is reproductively mature and whether it's pregnant. And that's really important because we want to know, for example, for right whales, why they aren't reproducing at such a high rate. We can get an idea. You can't tell really just by looking at it whether a female is pregnant, but by using fecal studies, you can actually get all of that information. So that's just the beginning. There's lots of other studies. You can also do genetic tests from feces as well.
On board your ship, what kind of equipment did you have? What kind of analysis were you actually doing, and what information were you getting out right then and there?
Sure. For that type of analysis, I mean, if you're asking about the feces for the humpbacks, we were analyzing the nitrogen. So we were studying the nitrogen levels right there and then looking at how it changed over time. Because as you would ask, does it break up? Does it sink out? How is it released? We did time series of the fecal analysis to get an idea of just how quickly that nitrogen could be released and potentially absorbed by the phytoplankton. Now, my colleagues on board would be analyzing that the dive tag data, the data that allowed them to look at how humpbacks are feeding beneath the surface. And humpbacks are long known for being cooperative feeders. That is, that people would observe them bubble net feeding, diving deep at the surface, and apparently putting a net of bubbles around a school of fish, then rising in the midst of that net and capturing a large amount of fish. It was long presumed when they saw many whales that they were working together. The dive tech data was interesting, showed that it looks like it's often one whale doing all the work and another one just coming in and mooching off. So much for that theory. So that was some of the work that they've been coming up with lately.
Do they switch off roles so that the moocher then does some work later on?
Too soon to tell, but my guess is no. It looked like it's often one doing most of the work, actually, and others sort of being opportunistically taking advantage. What the advantage is for the one that's doing all the work, we don't really know. You know what kind of relationship these whales have over the long term? You'd have to ask folks like Mason Weinrich and others who have been studying these individuals over the course of decades.
Isn't that always the way one does work?
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about the whale pump and, you know, what exactly are the nutrients in the whale dung? Is it primarily nitrogen used for algae?
There's iron as well, and that's important in the southern hemisphere. So the reason we looked at nitrogen is because in our coastal system, the limiting nutrient, the nutrient that's going to prevent growth, tends to be nitrogen. So that's the one we looked at. If it's very common, it doesn't, you know, it almost doesn't matter if it's released there. It's not going to be very ecologically important, at least as far as we know. However, researchers have been collecting feces, mostly from sperm whales, in the southern hemisphere, and they show that they're the same thing. They're diving deep, defecating at the surface. They're releasing iron-rich poop. It's the same poop, but the poop there, it's the iron that really matters. So they're analyzing that level and finding orders of magnitude much more iron in the poop than there is in the surrounding waters, indicating that the algae can feed on that. And presumably this could play a role in carbon sequestration, because the algae are absorbing those nutrients. It increases primary productivity, and then eventually that algae, either in the form, either by being consumed or dropping out of the system, could remove carbon and could play one small role in the global carbon cycle. So those are two nutrients. I mean, I'm sure phosphorus and other nutrients probably play a role as well. We just haven't looked at it yet.
So what's the difference between what you just called primary productivity and secondary productivity?
Sure. So the primary productivity is going to be algae and plants in a particular area, even some bacterial growth as well. So this is going to be productivity that occurs through photosynthesis. So it's going to be, it depends on the sunlight, and that's why we think the whale pump matters, is because they're releasing nutrients at the surface, and that's the only place where photosynthesis can occur. Can occur, of course, at depth where there's not enough light. Secondary productivity is going to be when they're consumed either by crustaceans or other zooplankton, and then after that consumed up the food web. By fish and eventually whales. And what the research is showing, that it's very complicated. Not only are the primary producers important, but so are the top level consumers. By recycling those nutrients, it's clear that they play an important role in the system. That remains controversial. You know, ours is one of the first studies to really look at the role of whales here. Others have been looking at the role of whales as consumers, and then after they eat, they die and drop out of the system. They might pull nutrients away from the surface and act as a form of carbon sequestration. So basically what we're showing is that these top-level consumers really play an important role in the ecosystem. And that's really an emerging theme.
Why don't fish serve the same function?
Mm-hmm. Well, think about it. A fish don't need to come to the surface to breathe necessarily. They're going to come to the surface to feed, and they'll dive down again to feed or perhaps to hide from predators. But they're not going to be going up and down across that thermocline in a regular fashion. And even if they do, they're going to be, on average, defecating or excreting at the same level that they're feeding. So they're not necessarily going to be bringing those nutrients up. They play an important role ecologically, of course, but not in that same way. There's no pump necessarily. Keep in mind that our whale pump is intended to play against what's been the traditional view, what's called a biological pump. And that is, for zooplankton and for other planktonic organisms, the nutrients tend to drop out. The biological pump is about growth at the surface, and then the nutrients dropping out either through feces, and this is for small organisms, through feces or death or migration, you'll lose those nutrients over time. Whales and other air-breathing vertebrates are the ones that are going to be bringing the nutrients back up in the other direction.
Part of what makes this all work is that the whale scat is buoyant.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes it buoyant?
Mostly it's going to be those fats. You think of a whale, the blubber, why they were so attractive. They're going to be feeding on lipid-rich or fat-rich organisms. Hence, their feces, just like the individuals, are going to be very rich in fats. One researcher had said, well, how do you know that it floats? Why do you think that they, or rather he had asked, why do you think they defecate at the surface? And I'd given him some answers thinking, well, one is because they're resting at the surface, they're metabolizing, we visualize it. And he said, well, actually, if the feces is so buoyant, perhaps they're defecating and farting, by the way, at the surface, because it can reduce their buoyancy. So in other words, when they want to make a deep dive, they'll excrete in order to get all that lightweight feces out, and that'll allow them to dive more efficiently.
Oh, interesting. Is whale dung the same buoyancy as, say, seals or walruses, or don't you know?
In short, I don't know. I suspect it is. It again, it depends on the diet.
Now, fish scat would sink to the bottom, is that right?
For largely for zooplankton, for planktonic organisms, that is the small crustaceans, they're going to have small pellets. Fish probably, we don't know if we don't know. It depends again on the species whether it's going to drop out or float at the surface. I've certainly people have observed fish scats. So again, there's probably a mix. So no simple answer for these species. I mean, think about the incredible diversity in the oceans. That's probably what we're finding, is that it's far more complicated than the system originally appeared.
Is this, basically moving nutrients from the ocean floor to the surface? Is this the main role of whales in ocean ecosystems, or do they play other roles as well?
Well, obviously, as con they'll be transporting nutrients not only up and down across the surface, but they're also up and down rather across the water column. But they're also migratory. Many of them are migratory, so they'll be traveling beyond from, let's say, the Gulf of Maine, where they go to feed, to other areas where they may die. They'll bring in nutrients through the system that way. Of course, traditionally, the most important role that it's assumed that they play is as top-level consumers. I mean, they're the large predators in those areas. It depends on, for some species, the ones that we think of as dolphins or porpoises, those ones, the toothed whales, they tend to be the fish eaters, whereas the baleen whales, like right whales and humpback whales, tend to eat lower on the food chain. So they'll be eating either smaller, what we call forage fish, or in the case of right whales, let's say copepods, which are microscopic organisms. So they play both an important role as far as releasing nutrients, but they're certainly playing a large role, of course, in the consumption of organisms throughout the world.
The broader implications for, say, restrictions on whaling or whale conservation, knowing that they're not just consuming,
Sure.
animals, but releasing nutrients too.
Right. The story that we've heard for years coming out of countries like Japan and Iceland and Norway is that whales and other marine mammals, including seals, and you hear this in Canada as well, are basically human competitors. They eat, quote unquote, our fish, and therefore, we should cull them or kill them. It's a justification for killing whales, and Japanese have used this for a long time to justify their scientific research whaling. What the whale pump and other studies are showing is that whales actually play a much more complicated role in the environment. They're not just consuming fish. And by the way, lots of studies also show that whales eat very different species than humans do, so they're not really in direct competition anyway. But be that as it may, there's clear indication that whales can actually sustain high populations of fish and productivity in areas where they're found, rather than being a rather than removing those nutrients and removing those organisms out of the system. As we've seen historically, we can probably have high levels of whales and high numbers of fish and high productivity in areas all at the same time. That actually motivated a lot of the work that we did, was hearing that argument and also seeing observing whales at sea, and knowing that clearly the story was far more complicated.
In all of your research, what have been some of the strangest observations or strange facts that you've uncovered, particularly maybe with the right whale?
Well, certainly among the most memorable events for any whale biologist working on the Gulf of Maine is if you're lucky enough to see a right whale courtship group. They're also known as surface active groups, because what you'll have is you'll have a female, and she'll be calling in the males. And we don't know whether this is intentional or not, but there'll be some calls that will attract males. And you could be, at offshore and see whales coming from around the horizon, male whales being attracted to the female. Female will swim on her back, so she can't breathe. So, and she'll have her ventral area to the surface, so it'll be hard for the males to mate with her. And it appears like she's trying to avoid them, and the males will be trying to mate with her from also swimming on their backs. And right whales have very large penises. They can be up to 9 feet long, and very large testicles as well, about the size of a washing machine.
Really?
The males are basically, they're not competing physically as much as they're what's called sperm competition. They're competing that for that female by trying to get the most sperm into her in the shortest amount of time. So this is really a spectacular event. I mean, you're seeing dozens of whales all trying to approach a single female at a time, and that's probably the first one that comes to mind, and certainly you wouldn't forget it.
Now, I have to ask, are other whales as well endowed as the right whale?
I think right whales and bowheads probably lead that. So certainly lead the field in that regard. And again, it's a product mostly because they are, like I said, they're not really competing by having large horns or some other physical armor. Rather, they're competing through their sperm and their ability to reach a female. So the female has to hold her breath, and that presumably, if she's swimming on her back, the male is going to have to do the same thing, hold his breath. She's testing his fitness that way. Can she swim alongside him? Can she copulate with him? Those are going to be the ones that are presumably the most fit, and are going to have the most fit offspring.
But how well has it worked, given that both are endangered?
Very good point. Well, this wasn't really, that's a good point. This probably wasn't, it didn't evolve with humans in mind. And they don't even know, they've run into our boat. The males are very focused at this time.
Oh, really?
they don't even notice we're there at that point.
So what does it feel like when a very focused, shall we say, right whale male runs into your boat?
Yeah, you get very nervous, let's say that. I'll give you one more story, and this one I've only heard, I haven't experienced, but there were some researchers on the Pacific studying, and I believe it was humpback whales, and same thing, the humpback whale was swimming on her back, and there was a male trying to copulate with her, and apparently she swam under the boat, and the whale's penis came into the boat, trying to reach the female. So apparently she was using the boat as something like a diaphragm.
So they have good control with their
yes,
anatomy.
They do.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about whales and whale poop with Joe Roman, author of Whale and assistant professor at the University of Vermont's Rubenstein School for the Environment and Natural Resources.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the Animal Wise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally, and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.